everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail.
Yes, we do.
Yes, we do. My name is William Bibbiani. I'm a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. For the purposes of this podcast, you may call me Rockmeister McCool.
And I encourage
you're not
you to
required.
So. No, no one is required to do anything, but I encourage you to you do so. Take your shot.
Call me anything you like. Call me late for dinner. But this is our letters podcast. This is where you get to control the conversation. Send us an email or write us a physical letter, and we will answer it.
Yep. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
Send us a physical letter to Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
You don't have to do it as angrily as he just spit that out.
You can get like a big thick marker that makes it look like you're mad when you're writing it. But we'll answer your letters. We like it. We like getting your letters. We like hearing from you.
Really
you
do.
Get to talk about the whatever you want to talk about.
Yeah, and feel free. Like people ask us questions about how things work in the industry. People ask us our opinions about things. People take us to task for things that we got wrong, or if you disagree with a review and you really like something we disliked, or vice versa. That's fair game too. This time is yours. You can be about nothing. It can be about silly, weird stuff. Okay, you can totally go nuts. Okay, this is your time. What do you want to hear us talk about on the show? And we don't like to dilly-dally, so let's just jump right into our first email.
Yeah, here we go.
Whitney, what have we got?
Here is a letter from J-Lo, but Hi. Specifically not that one.
That's fine,
so
too.
So this is not Jennifer Lopez.
Listen, I want to say this right now. Mm-hmm. I like Jennifer Lopez.
If she wrote in, we'd just read
that'd
the letter.
I'd be fine with that, yeah. Fine.
Maybe she's listening to the show. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi! I loved you in Hustlers.
Hustlers is excellent.
You were snubbed for an Oscar in Hustlers.
It's a great movie.
Yeah.
But J-Lo says, gents, once more, Bibbs has posed a science question that had me trying to talk back to my speaker to explain.
Oh, no.
So it seems like another email is in order.
Okay.
In a recent episode of All Our Yesterdays, that's our Star Trek podcast, Bibbs asked why they included the .0 at the end of a star date.
Okay. For anyone who doesn't know what we're talking about here, if you don't watch Star Trek, most Star Trek episodes and movies begin by announcing the year, but the year is like
it's space calendar.
Well, it's like, you know how like there's BC and then there's like AD, and like basically there was this huge historical event and everything before it is before Christ, and everything afterwards is Anno Domini, in the year of our Lord, or Common Era if you prefer today, before Common Era. The idea is that once we hit space travel, that was so huge it started like a new timeline, basically. We started
new
total times.
Well, because we can't just go by Earth calendars, because it's other planets now. We have to sort of come up with a universal calendar for all planets.
So most Star Trek episodes and or movies begin with at least one person saying something to the effect of star date 4293.0. And the implication is that 4293, whatever like that, that's like the year and assumably like the specific day. But the question is, what is the point? And it's usually like 0.1, and we assume that that's roughly equivalent to like 1 in the morning or whatever.
The point is like the hour.
Right. But there was one episode recently where they said 0.0, and I, mostly just being cheeky, said, isn't that kind of redundant? Do we even need to say 0.0? Here we are now.
So Bibbs asked why I include the 0.0 at the end of a star date, and that it should be the same as a whole number.
Yeah.
As a new Trekkie, I can't get into the specifics of star dates, but after a year of chem classes in college, I can at least mention the importance of a 0.0. Mm-hmm. A quick oversimplification, when talking about measurements, there is only so much accuracy that can be attained, and a measurement is only accurate to plus or minus one in whatever decimal position last reported.
Okay.
So a measurement like 16.5 kilograms on an analog scale would be anywhere from 16.4 to 16.6.
Right. Okay. Makes sense. There's always a little wiggle room. Yeah.
Assuming that the star date is somehow based on a metric system, saying that star date is like 2670 could be anywhere from 2669 to 2671, whereas a star date with a trailing zero would be like plus or minus 0.1. So like if they give the whole number, that means there's like a whole day margin of error. Whereas if they include the 0.0, there's less margin of error.
Okay, I can kind of see that. Yeah. And even then, the 0.0 implies that, like, close enough.
Yeah, what the unit of measurement is, I can't really say, but adding the trailing zero is important.
Okay.
It's also worth noting that significant figures involve an element of human rounding with analog instruments. For something less scientifically rigid as a captain's log, a wide margin of error should be fine. But I'm sure the medical and scientific departments have much more accurate time measuring implements.
Okay.
Also, the little kid who wanted to run away from calculus was a big mood. there's an episode where it's established that in the future of Star Trek,
yeah,
you take calculus when you're like
in the fourth grade.
Like, yeah, when you're like eight,
it's like super important to know calculus. Like, it's not optional. Like when I was,
it's like we learn arithmetic now, but yeah. Now,
well, when I was in high school, only so much math was like required. Like, you had to get through, I think, like algebra two. Or okay. something like that, but like anything, you know, you didn't have to take trigonometry. You didn't have to take calculus per se. Right. Those were elective math. In Star Trek, no, you're gonna do that when you're a little kid. Yeah.
But yeah,
there's a whole episode with the little kid wants,
I don't want to go to calculus class. So yeah, the little kid who wanted to run away from calculus was a big mood. Glad to report that I finished Calc 2. Ooh. And won't need any more calc while finishing up my associate's degree. And shouldn't need any more while pursuing my bachelor's either. Jazz to start season two, sincerely, J-Lo.
J-Lo, I'm with you on that. Mm-hmm. I think I've told this story before, but I had to take, when we take our SATs, which is a standardized testing we have in the United States, a lot of, like, you know, it has your scores in the SATs, you're graded on math, language skills in a couple of different fields.
Every high school kid takes an almost every high school kid takes an SAT.
And they're starting to become less popular now, which is good. It's a flawed system, but whatever. In any case, there was a rule at the college I went to, UCLA, that like if you had math scores above a 630, I think it was, you didn't have to take another math class unless it was required for your major.
Okay.
Like, you could just not take math.
You just automatically.
Like, if you have a major that requires a lot of math, you got to do a lot of math. That's out of it. But, like, if you're going to go into, like, American history, you don't have to do another math class. Mm. I took my SATs, and I did really, really well in English and, like, the verbal. I did great. Really, really awesome. Very proud of my scores. And then for math, I got a 620.
So, just under the required
number. And I was like, fuck this. And so I crammed my ass off and I went in and I took my SAT again and I got a 640.
Ah, you did it.
I didn't learn a lot more math, but I got two more questions right and then I didn't have to take math again. It was the best. Yeah, so I'm totally with you. If you're not, if math is not your thing, I'm totally understand your relation at not needing to take anymore.
Math was my thing.
Oh, wow.
I always loved numbers. I was one of the few kids who was not just good at geometry, but loved it.
Oh, well, you're really like shooting a hole in my theory that film critics are just people who are bad at math.
Well,
because that's me.
I'm getting to that.
Oh, sorry.
I did fine in math throughout, you know, elementary school. Yeah. I did okay in math in junior high. I ended up having to take I got the C+ in pre-algebra, but my elementary school is one of those, you know, grade-free, not-so-standard, not-so-test-oriented kinds of schools. It's teaching you more about life experience. So I didn't test very well when I got to a school where they actually started to give out grades.
Yeah.
And so I had to take two units of pre-algebra, and then I took algebra in the ninth grade.
Okay.
So by the time I got to the end of high school, I had taken trig. I took algebra 1 and 2, I took geometry, and I took trig. And I liked all of those, and I did incredibly well in all of those classes.
Great.
And I figured by the time I get to college, first year in college, I can take calculus. Finally move into that, this mysterious new math.
Yeah.
That I heard so much about from the
you're
film Stand
in the
and
engineering
Deliver.
Engineering room in Star Trek, that next thing you know, like, you're going to be like great at math.
The, like, repeating series of numbers, and this is all going to be very, very exciting. And the first day of Calc, they said, everything you've learned up until now, that's just, like, number basics. This is, like, more applied math, and it's going to be very, very different from what you're used to.
Yeah.
It's like a whole totally new set of rules. Yeah. And I did so bad in calculus. Yeah. I actually ended up, like, very high fail in that class, but I failed calculus.
You were trying really, really hard, but it wasn't.
But I wasn't grasping it. For some reason, I, like, hit a wall when it came to calculus.
Yeah.
So I took it again, and I barely passed the second time. And I was done with math after that, because I just couldn't roll with calculus the same way I was rolling with, like, trig and algebra and geometry and all these other things. I was just got my head, even chemistry and physics, like, I was getting my head around these things really well.
Yeah.
Calculus is a brick.
Yeah. Well, it happens, right? You're pushing yourself at those institutes of higher learning. But in any case, thank you for that. That actually does explain that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really good explanation for that. Thank you for that.
Scientific number.
For why there needed to be a 0.0, because you're right. Yeah, otherwise it would have been just the whole day. I get it. Nicely done. Thank you so much. And I learned something.
Very good.
Thank you.
Also, if the what if the captain has to make a second entry for that day? Then they then have to include the decimal.
I get it. Right. I'm with you. Anyway, although you'd think the computer is logging what time it's being recorded and they don't need to say it.
I suppose so.
Yeah.
Maybe they have to say it.
I think Star Trek started doing that like before they had any inclination that computers would ever be able to do that really easily. And then by the time we knew computers could do that really, really easily, it's just kind of grandfathered into the premise.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. Anyway, moving on.
Here's a letter from Tom, T-O-M, exclamation point.
Oh, shit.
Tom.
Tom.
Hey, Tom.
Hi, Tom.
Hello to my two favorite critics.
Thanks.
Oh, push on. Yeah. I recently watched Titan, later in the UK, thanks to a staggered release, and I loved it. Easily one of my top five films of last year. Anyway, while watching Titan, I couldn't help but draw two huge parallels to another movie that it shared some incredible similarities to that it cannot be coincidental.
Okay.
In 2012, there was a fantastic documentary released called The Imposter. It told the true story of a missing child and how a grown man pretended or impersonated that child and wormed his way into the family's home, seemingly fooling them, although this is heavily debated in the film.
Mm-hmm.
Did the family really not see that the child was clearly not their son, or were they just lacking any possible outcome for the sake of closure?
Right. I remember hearing about that. I never saw that. I remember hearing about that.
It was a good film. I did see that one. This is incredibly similar to the plot of Titan, where a woman pretends to be the son of a fireman and works her way into his home and family. The connection they share is also left open. Does the fireman really not see that this is clearly not his son, or is he also being naive after having dealt with the trauma of losing his child? Mm-hmm. This is answered in the film, but it remains open for the majority of the runtime.
Right.
Both films also feature a cover of Wayfaring Stranger performed by 16 Horsepower, a relatively obscure band and cover, with the imposter using it to great effect in a truly haunting scene at the end of the movie.
Wow.
When The Imposter came out in 2012, I remember looking for the song on YouTube and only finding one single upload of the song with under 1,000 views, proving that this song isn't well known either, and I haven't heard it being used or mentioned in anything since.
Yeah, that right there.
That's a little too much to be a coincidence.
You went from, okay, there's an interesting parallel here, that could be a coincidence, to finding something where it's just like, now it's become implausible that it's a coincidence.
Julliard du Carnot definitely saw that movie.
Well, almost definitely.
The music supervisor.
It would be a hell of a coincidence. Yeah, that's a great observation.
Both films presenting similar stories, themes, and obscure covers cannot be a pure coincidence, and I would hazard to guess that someone working on T10 had watched The Imposter and took some of the beats and elements as inspiration or a potential guideline.
Makes sense.
My question is, do you know of any similar things where two movies share some weird coincidences both in front of or behind the camera? Thanks for all you do. Your podcast keeps me company on my 2-hour work commutes. Tom!
Thank you so much for that. That's interesting. Mm. I didn't know about that one. That's kind of fun.
Let's see. What is...
We were just talking about Star Trek, and Star Trek has this theory of parallel development, where the idea is that...
Are you going to do DS9 and Babylon 5?
Kind of. The idea in Star Trek is that if intelligent civilizations evolved on different planets, they would probably evolve in somewhat similar ways, in that they would invent this technology before that technology, because that's the most logical way to do that. Like, you'd probably invent fire before you invented dynamite, that kind of thing. And as a result, a lot of civilizations will go through certain parallel stages of development. Like, you'll both go through an Iron Age. You'll both go through, like, whatever. And there might be some cultural similarities as well as a result of that. And this works artistically as well. And there's a lot of examples throughout Hollywood history of similar projects emerging more or less at the same time. Often just initially just because two people had a similar idea.
Yeah.
But then one idea ends up, you know, getting picked up, and Variety reports that, oh, hey, there's, I forget which one came first, but like, oh, hey, there's going to be a volcano movie coming out called Dante's Peak. And then one studio is like, well, we had a volcano script, didn't we? Well, fuck it. Let's do it. Like, volcanoes are in right now. And so they came out with Volcano, or vice versa. I forget which one came first. This kind of thing happens kind of a lot. Yeah,
there's the same year that Bugs Life and Ants came out.
Yeah.
They came out within a couple months of each other. There was Deep Impact and Armageddon, two big comet apocalypse movies came out within a couple months of each other. One that I found really uncanny was the movie Simon Birch. which was based on a John Irving novel.
Yeah.
And a movie called The Mighty shared a lot of similarities.
They do. Yeah.
And those came out within a few months.
I never saw Simon Birch. The Mighty is quite good, though.
I like The Mighty. I like them both.
Okay.
I think The Mighty is the better film.
Okay. But the example you brought up was, and this is a case where there's actually been some sort of question about it, J. Michael Straczynski, a famed sci-fi writer, had pitched an idea for a Star Trek spinoff that instead of taking place on a ship that was traveling throughout the galaxy, took place on a big space station, and everyone in the galaxy would eventually come to them because there's this big hub of diplomacy and commerce. Star Trek passed on this, and so he took it somewhere else. Somewhere else said yes. And around the time when he was working on this show, which would come to be called Babylon 5, Star Trek just happened to develop a spinoff that was set at a space station called Deep Space Nine, and they ended up coming out at almost the exact same time.
I think Babylon 5 technically beat Deep Space Nine to the punch. Let me look up.
But
the
they were
date clear,
but
the
they
Babylon
were clearly being made around the same
TV
time,
movie,
and it's
yeah.
sort of, and there's a sort of thing where like no, I don't think anyone's ever directly made an accusation, but almost every yeah. single time it comes up, there's always this very pregnant pause where it's just like, where like that doesn't look good, does it? We're not accusing anyone of anything, but it doesn't look good.
Oh, Deep Space Nine beat Babylon 5 to the air by a year.
Yeah.
Because DS9 started in 93 and Babylon 5 came out in 94.
Yeah.
Who's zooming who here? It's not really clear. When Michael J. Straczynski...
J. Michael Straczynski
presented his pitch. Maybe they were already working on a space station Star Trek show.
Yeah.
Who's to say?
Yeah.
This is not a Harlan Ellison situation. Nobody's sued anybody, but there's a lot of dark coincidences.
But oftentimes in cases like this where a movie does seem to have properly ripped someone off, there is a lawsuit. Case in point, Harlan Ellison. When James Cameron made the movie The Terminator, was the movie that made his career. He'd only directed one low-budget horror sequel before, and he'd done a lot of work behind the scenes. But The Terminator was this incredibly ambitious, relatively low-budget action adventure with a really big high concept. And James Cameron, if you watch a lot of Outer Limits, you'll see like there's similarities to a couple of episodes, particularly one called Soldier and another one called Demon with a Glass Hand. And if you look at like, oh, that could be coincidence. That could just be like good ideas working the same way. And then I believe it was in an issue of Starlog when James Cameron said, and I took my influence in these couple of Outer Limits episodes, at which point Harlan Ellison went, you owe me some motherfucking money.
And he sued him.
And now Harlan Ellison's name is on that movie now.
He's not a credited writer. There's some sort of like special consultation credit. Like
yeah.
He has a credit, but it's not as a writer.
Yeah.
But yeah, he won that case. Harlan Ellison won that case.
So that's another example right there. Harlan Ellison sued a lot of people for shit like that.
There's a joke in an episode of Freakazoid where they stumble into a science fiction convention.
Yeah.
Freakazoid's being chased by Fanboy. He's a supervillain.
Yeah.
He fans out and he gives you film trivia until you're bored and you fall asleep. It's like, I need you to stop chasing me. What if I gave you the script to the just recently written Batman movie? Ah, I plucked that off the internet last night. How about if I give you your very own Harlan Ellison? And he hands him Harlan Ellison. And in what I think is one of the wickedest jokes on the show, Fanboy looks at him and it says, "Who's that?" It's so fucking rude.
Ouch.
How about your very own Harlan Ellison?
Nice.
Who's that?
In any case, another example of a successful lawsuit was Fistful of Dollars.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, Fistful of Dollars was the film that made Sergio Leone's career. It was the first film of the Man with No Name trilogy. Great motion picture.
Did Kurosawa sue him?
Yeah.
Oh, no kidding. Okay.
Yeah. So Sergio Leone ripped the fuck off of the film Yojimbo, directed by Kirk Kurosawa, directed by Toshirô Mifune.
Rather well-known remake of Yojimbo.
But it wasn't originally called a remake.
Oh,
originally, it was just a movie that happened to have a lot of similarities. And by happened to have a lot of similarities, I mean the plot is exactly the same, and many of the shots and editing choices are exactly the same.
The dog with the hand in its mouth is in both.
So Kurosawa sued, Well, yeah, I'm looking at Kurosawa insisted that Leone had made a fine movie, but it was my movie. Yeah. So I apologize. They settled out of court.
Okay.
For 15% of the worldwide receipts of A Fistful of Dollars, and that was a very successful movie.
Oh, Kurosawa died a rich man then, didn't
he? Yeah, he did fine. So, generally speaking, you want to call your shots.
Yeah.
That could be, but I don't think what we're talking about with Titan is necessarily legally actionable.
No.
Especially because it was like based off of like a true story and what you can do about that. But Luca, what are you doing?
Chewing on something.
Luca, he's playing with the one of the toys. You're actually supposed to be doing that. I'm the jerk.
Yeah, you got him that toy.
So I did. And for once, he's actually playing with a toy we got him. Instead of like knocking over glasses and breaking them, so thank you for that.
They don't put them on milk cartons anymore, but used to be able to like sort of peel the thing off the cap.
Oh yeah,
we would always peel it off and just throw it over our shoulders, because the cats loved playing with those things.
Stuff. In any case, that sounds like the song is not legally actionable. It sounds like it's just inspiration, and they're calling their shot, but with that song. But it's a fun one.
What was the Cancel Too Soon animated series we did about Sergeant Pectoral and his testicular commandos?
Oh, the G.I. Joe one.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, it was Sergeant. What's that? Hold on a second. I'll look it up. I can't remember the exact
title. It's like the biggest, manliest cartoon show ever. It's like not Sergeant Slaughter. It's like Sergeant Savage.
Sergeant Savage and his Screaming Eagles. And it was basically the G.I. Joe story that you all know and love from like people like, you know, Snake Eyes and Destro and Cobra Commander. That was like super duper popular in the 80s, and it started like winding down and not selling as many toys in the 90s. And so they decided to reboot it somewhat by creating new characters and new action figures and new vehicles and stuff in the 90s. And it never got further than a pilot. You could get that pilot because they would sell it with the toys. So it was like on a VHS. Mm-hmm. But they never made another show with it. The pilot was Captain America.
Yeah.
Like, literally, this guy was like the biggest hero in World War II.
World War II soldier.
He goes missing, and he's been like cryogenically frozen, and he wakes up with superpowers, and then he assembles a team of heroes to fight, he teams up to fight Hydra, because the whole thing is, like, these Nazis have been, like, hiding out in plain sight in capitalism this whole time, and they've just been waiting to strike. I mean, granted, the Hydra thing was a bit more modern, but regardless, like that, the Captain America ripoff is huge.
I don't know if there was any kind of action taken. Yeah. Maybe because the show wasn't successful, they didn't feel the need to.
Battlestar Galactica got sued.
Here's a good obscure one. Yeah. Because the source and what ripped it off are both incredibly obscure.
Okay.
But there was a Super Nintendo video game called Booger Man. And you played you played as a superhero that would flick boogers at the bad guys.
I vaguely remember this, yes.
And they called it a pick and flick adventure. They're trying to be really gross about it. Mucus-based video.
Thank you, Nickelodeon. Thank you so bloody much.
I'm also a big fan of a radio drama company called ZBS. And they have a series of science fiction stories starring Ruby, the Galactic Gumshoe. Look up ZBS. Mm-hmm. Shell out as much money as you can spare to buy their radio dramas, because they're all wonderful.
Okay.
But in Ruby 2, which I think was put out in like 81 or 82, the characters, their minds are being sort of taken over by pop media. Mm-hmm. And in the show, characters watch this TV program called The Booger Man. And it shows up as, I'm the Booger Man. It's more like a monster. And he says, I'm going to pick and flick. And he says pick and flick a lot. Uh-huh. And he's called Booger Man.
Weird.
About a decade later, one of the guys who developed this game just happened to be a subscriber to ZBS.
Oh.
And comes out with this video game called Booger Man.
Uh-oh.
And people wrote in letters to ZBS, this like little public radio station in New York. It's like, are you going to sue this guy? It's like, I'm not going to sue Data East. First of all, I'm not a litigious person. I really don't care. They made a booger video game. Let them have it. I'm fine.
Okay. That seemed to remind me of one more, and we got to move on after that. But it took people a while to put this one together. But you might have heard of a little franchise called Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
It's a story of a kid named Harry Potter who finds out there's a whole magical world full of monsters and stuff, and he has to learn magic in order to save the day. That's an extreme oversimplification, and I'm putting it that way on purpose. That's because in the late 80s, there was a film called Troll,
With a character named Harry
With
Potter.
With a little kid named Harry Potter, literally named Harry Potter, who has to learn magic to save the day from a magical troll, which turns people into plants and kills Sonny Bono.
That's right.
Sonny Bono was in that. There's a scene where he turns into a tree, and it's actually really gross, and it kind of scared me when I was a kid. But in any case, yeah,
That's scary when you're a kid.
It's pretty scary. Like, it's you know, scarier than Troll 2, that's for sure. Anyway, Troll 1, not a very good film. People would say, like, oh, Troll 2 is one of the worst movies ever, and I'm like, Troll 1 was not good either.
Troll 2 is also quite bad.
Yeah, Troll 2 is worse, but Troll 1 also sucks. But in any case, there was some sort of giggles and amusement. I would be very surprised if that goes any... If J.K. Rowling had seen it, I'd be somewhat surprised. B, if she had seen it and she actually did any intentional basing off of it, I'd be super duper shocked. The most I can think of is that maybe at some point J.K. Rowling saw this movie on TV. Was like, oh, Harry Potter, that's a good name.
Kind of like sunk into her subconscious somewhere.
Just the name. Just the name stuck in.
You watch Day of the Locust, and Donald Sutherland's character is named Homer Simpson, for instance.
Well, you look at, and this is an intentional homage, but you look at, in the Star Wars Clone Wars, there's a character named Commander Cody. And he's
named after the old 40s series.
And he's got a jetpack, just like the Commando Cody serials about a guy with a jetpack, based on the Rocketeer is based on that.
But that's so, that's deliberate.
That's deliberate. My point is this. It's just basically, I like that name. Right. So big thing. Anyway, we should move on.
Move on. Here's a letter from Name Redacted. There's no name at the end of this one. Hello to the better version of the WWE Network, the William Whitney Entertainment Network.
Nice.
I've been listening to you guys since 2017. I've been listening to Bibbs since he was on What the Flick. I miss What the Flick.
Me
I
like too. That was a great book.
I really, really love and appreciate you guys, and I'm looking forward to many more years of hearing your voices in my head.
Thank you.
I'm sure many will be sending you the list of their best of the year, as I have yet to catch up on a lot of films this year. I'll instead make a list of the best movies I've seen based on your recommendations.
Okay.
Number 10, The Hunger.
Okay.
Number 9, The Car from 1977. I saw that for the first time recently.
The Hunger is the Tony Scott lesbian vampire movie. Susan Sarandon. That's a great movie.
Susan Sarandon, who in an interview said, they added us drinking wine in the script before we went to bed together. Like anyone would need wine to go to bed with Catherine Deneuve.
Right?
Good for her.
Yeah.
Number 8, The Stuntman. I saw that for the first time.
I'm so glad. If we got just one person to see The Stuntman.
Stuntman's really good.
Nobody talks about it. It's one of the best movies ever made about movies. Just please see it. It's so good.
And number 7, Christine from 2016.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Number 6, Rockula.
Yay! That's one of my favorite cult movies. It's a great Halloween musical. It's very funny and sweet. I love it.
Number 5, Vamps. This is all you, because I haven't seen Vamps.
Vamps is, I'll real fast.
It's Amy Heckerling?
It's Amy Heckerling. Yeah. I was literally talking to my partner, M. Lopez da Silva, and they were just like, I want to watch something and I don't know what to watch. Is there anything that's kind of like Clueless but with vampires? And I was like, oh my God, did you just say the magic words?
The director of Clueless made a movie about vampires.
Yeah, with the star of Clueless and a couple of the other stars of Clueless, because Wallace Shawn is in it too.
Oh, great.
And Vamps is a wonderful movie about Alicia Silverstone and Kristen Ritter as vampires in the modern day and how it's all just kind of sweet and fun. And it's really funny and cute. And you should totally see it. Please see Vamps. I love it so much.
Number 4. Oh God, I can take blame for this one. Freeway parts 1 and 2.
Oh, 2. Whoa. Okay.
Have you seen Freeway 2?
No, but it's just usually people don't bother.
After seeing the first Freeway.
Well, it's just not as well talked about, is it?
And there's even a comment on this one. I believe secretly that these two movies are the nightmares of every racist or sexist white cis male.
Wow.
Freeway, directed by Matthew Bright,
starring Reese Witherspoon, Kiefer Sutherland, Brooke Shields,
Richard Elfman, peripherally involved. It is like sleazy and disgusting.
Yeah.
In the best possible way.
It's like this modern ultra sleazy remake or update.
It's a riff on Red Riding Hood.
Yeah, basically. But like, what if the wolf was like a serial killer, like stalking the highways and stuff like that? And what if the Red Riding Hood was like a delinquent? And a total badass.
Every melodramatic scare film sleaze tactic is employed in this movie. And there's Freeway 2 it's the Hansel and Gretel story.
Oh, I didn't know that one.
It's Natasha Lyonne and her girlfriends like flee from prison and they're trying to find sort of like the grandmother or the Wicked Witch in the Woods is like this evil nun who's running a sex cult, and the nun is played by Vincent Gallo.
Oh, what?
It's really bizarre.
Is it good?
It's as sleazy as the first. It's cheaper, so it feels a little bit more scrappy. But it's not as good as Freeway, but I like it. Number three, In the Mouth of Madness. That's one of my favorites. Yep. Number two, Sneakers. We talk about that movie all the time. And number one, Sorry to Bother You.
Ah, cool.
Yeah, the Boots Riley film. P.S. I recommend the show Mrs. Fletcher as the next Cancel Too Soon show.
Signed,
name redacted.
I will make a note of that. Thank you for that. And hey, I really like this. And if anyone else wants to do this, send in a list of if you've ever seen movies based on our recommendations, you know, if we've made you aware of something, you sought something out and you really dug it. And if you want to like send us like a list of like movies that you took a chance on because of us, no pressure. If you've never done that, sorry. Mm-hmm. Or if we failed you, sorry about that too. But if you've ever done that, that'd be really cool to hear. I like that. That was fun.
Oh, we just got a letter too.
Oh shit. Okay. So the rule is
if we get a letter while we're recording, we have to read it right away.
That's the rule. That's the rule. We never record at the same time every week. In fact, we're recording a very different time than usual this week. So you never know when we're recording. So always take a chance.
Just send it in. Just send it in. All right. We might get it while we're recording.
Let's do it. What do we got?
Here's a letter from Jeremy. Hello, Jeremy.
Hi, Jeremy.
Greeting Bibbs and Rockmeister McCuel with a very creative spelling. I'm sorry this email isn't as timely. We just got it. It isn't as timely as I would have liked to have sent it, but while talking about Monty Python's film catalog, Bibbs had mentioned The Life of Brian is quite the heretical film, and I wish to address that thought. I'm a guy who was raised as a Baptist. I spent his college days practicing Anglicanism, and in 2013 I was confirmed in the Catholic Church. I got a bachelor's degree studying theology and got almost enough credits to get a degree in Old Testament studies. It was my inability to learn Hebrew that ruined my getting that degree. From what I understand, it's difficult for non-Hebrew speakers to learn Hebrew.
Okay.
So with my studies and background, I want to say that Monty Python's Life of Brian is surprisingly not heretical. It actually treats God and Jesus rather fairly. The only words you actually hear Jesus speak in the movie are from the Sermon on the Mount.
True.
Ripped right from the pages of the Bible. Sure, you got the people in the back row not hearing properly. Blessed are the cheesemakers. And that is where the brilliance of the movie comes from. It isn't mocking God or even any specific religion, Christianity, but rather it is making fun of the process of how religious practices get developed, or another way of saying it, the human element of organized religion.
Yeah, the idea is that no sooner had Jesus given a Sermon on the Mount than the people misinterpret him.
Yeah, although there is the opening scene in Life of Brian where the three wise men enter the Nativity.
Yeah, and they go to the wrong hut.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll talk when we're done.
But Jesus is intact in there. Nothing bad happens to Jesus
in that movie other than, like, even in that movie. Nothing bad happens except for being fucking crucified.
But
that doesn't happen in this film. I don't think it's happening.
I think there's a shot where they see, like, the crosses in the distance.
But is it Jesus in there, though? Because I know they're crucified people on the rag. Like, it wasn't my point is this.
Jesus' story
is untouched by Monty Python's inanity.
Yeah.
We'll talk.
But there's more in this letter. Yes. If God revealed himself to humanity, such an experience would need to be told. It isn't something you can really keep to yourself. It would be like you seeing a movie that revolutionized the entire industry. It demands comment. People, whether they did experience God or hallucinated or some other thing, had a theophany and needed to comment. A theophany. That's not a word I know.
That's a great word.
But that the person passes away and their student starts to keep that experience going by talking about it. Then they are removed from the person who's the source of the experience. So personal thoughts start creeping in and disagreements grow. The argument of, well, that's how Mr. So-and-so would have said it. So the strange web of thought, which has its roots in the original person, starts fracturing and expanding as more and more time goes on. And sometimes the arguments can get petty and maybe even mean-spirited. And then there are wars and assassinations and abuses of power, etc., etc. All Monty Python did was remove time and jumped straight to the bullshit. It's the shoe, follow the shoe. It's not a shoe, it's a sandal. We need to gather shoes. Hold your shoe above your head as a sign. Don't follow the shoe, follow the gourd. Give me your shoe. It feels like a glimpse into some of the real sorts of debates that happened in church history.
Sure.
Sometimes you feel like they rather lost the point, those historical church leaders. Also, what Monty Python is doing is poking fun at Second Temple period sectarian Judaism.
Ah.
That's just a fancy way of saying the time when Jesus would have been walking around Jerusalem.
Right.
That time historically was fraught with rebellions trying to forcibly end Roman occupation, which caused the Romans to clamp down harder on the people of Israel, which led to a more social disturbances, and Rome clamped down even harder, and so on and so on. Mm-hmm. The Jewish people of the time were desperate to get out from under Roman occupation because their being there was an affront to the promise they claimed were to their ancient father Abraham. So some of those rebel leaders took on the mantle of Messiah to try and rally their religious fervor to get the people on their side. Hmm. But people suck, and no one could agree on how they should do such and such, or who should be their leader. So that's why you get the Judean People's Front and the People's Front of Judea, the Popular People's Front, or the Judean Popular People's Front. Splinter. So yeah, maybe there was a... wasn't a row of messiahs lining the street spouting the ideological idioms, but that John Cleese response to Brian demanding he was not the one true messiah. He says, "I say you are, and I should know. I've followed a few." It's fucking genius. That practically summed up the whole joke of the movie. People suck, and sometimes we just don't know what we're talking about.
Right.
And lastly, sorry, this is rather long. I've probably written a whole paper on this topic.
I already have read
this paper.
Yeah.
Crucifying the whole cast at the end. Anyone who says that was blasphemous doesn't know anything about the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
You start a rebellion against Rome? Crucifixion. Yeah. You murdered someone? Crucifixion. You stole from the rich? Crucifixion. You jaywalked? Crucifixion.
Crucifixion? Very well. One cross on the left.
Yeah, line of left, one cross each. Rome hung so many people on crosses, not just one guy born in Bethlehem with two randos beside him.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, the crucifix, the portrayal of Jesus on the cross, I would say is something not to be tampered with, but crucifixion as a punishment is brutal, vile, disgusting, painful, torturous, and I'm not surprised in the slightest that Monty Python would use this as the backdrop for the song Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. Again, a fucking genius.
Yeah.
That is one of the greater comedy moments just in cinema.
I
Always Look on the Bright Side of Life scene.
It's one of the great comedy moments in cinema. It's one of the greatest songs ever written for a movie. This is not me bragging. This is just historical fact. I was valedictorian in my high school. And there was I know. It doesn't matter now. But like, it was, at the time, it was seen as kind of a big deal. And there were a lot of people who were really putting pressure on me. Like, hey, listen, I'm the first person in my family to graduate from high school. You need to make sure you really bring it with this fucking speech. And I'm like, Jesus. All right. God. And I couldn't think of anything to do. So I sang Always Look on the Bright Side of Life.
Aw. That's really cute.
Yeah.
There are reports of in the British Army, a ship was sinking, and the soldiers were standing on the deck as the ship was sinking, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. I think they were rescued, but yeah, it was kind of like a little bit of irony there.
I know, real fast, just to finish this point, one of the coolest interviews I've ever done in my whole life was I got to interview Eddie Izzard and Eric Idle together.
Oh God,
that was a great day for me. But I got to tell Eric Idle that story, and Eddie Izzard was like, "I've been telling Eric this. As far as I'm concerned, that is Earth's national anthem. It's Always Look on the Bright Side of Life."
Jeremy goes on. I'm sorry if that was rather long, but
no, you're fine.
I'm just convinced that people who get angry about the life of Brian being blasphemous either A, haven't actually watched the movie, or B, don't get the point of the movie. With that, I sign off. I hope the both for you best. Sincerely, Jeremy.
Jeremy, thank you so much for that. And we were talking about this in our list of the best films based on television series, and we both picked for our Monty Python film, because we easily could have done more than one Monty Python film.
Yeah.
Holy Grail. I believe what I said was something to the effect of, I love Life of Brian, but I think what I was trying to get at is that it's kind of controversial. And I understand why some people think it's controversial. And I think there are elements of the film, I think you're right about everything that they were trying to get at. I think there are elements of the film that come across better than others now. I think there are a few scenes, a few monologues and tirades that in a vacuum, and maybe even in context, aren't great, but I agree that the overall purpose of the film is to deconstruct how fanaticism begins and how it emerges from good intention.
It's a criticism of church corruption.
Yeah.
Not God.
And how church corruption doesn't even have to be dogmatic.
Mm.
It's just people...
weird human foibles that are entering into this system of the divine, a system of the infinite, and it's that's a kind of a rather strange juxtaposition that we find all of civilization existing inside of.
I don't think every single thing that gets targeted in Life of Brian is targeted equally. And I think some people will take some umbrage at that. And I think there's something to be said for that, but it's a longer conversation for a longer time. I'm glad you wrote in that email, because I think that movie is often a bit misunderstood. Yeah. And I'm glad we had... It does support my overall thesis, though, which is that Monty Python and a lot of their humor comes from knowing a lot about history. And they made some very smart films.
Agreed.
Yeah. All right. We got time for one or two more.
All right. Here is a letter from Benjamin. Hello, Benjamin.
Hi.
Good day to you, Bibbs and Rockmeister... Rockmeister Rocker.
Ooh.
I'll take it.
Is that from Santa Claus is Coming to Town?
I don't know.
Burgermeister Burger. I think it's the name of the bad guy in that special. Yeah.
After watching The Harder They Fall, I decided to watch some more classic Westerns, as they are a feel-good genre for me.
Cool.
I watched Silverado for the first time and really liked it.
Okay.
And went back to one of my old favorites, the classic Young Guns. As part of the plot of that film, the heroes are being chased by a bounty hunter, John Kinney. And at the climax of the film, one of the characters, while mortally wounded, shoots him. This made me start wondering about the effectiveness of characters with no lines in films. We don't see John Kinney say anything in the film, and still the final shootout, he's just a guy on a horse with a big white hat in the distance. What is your take on characters that are supposed to be plot significant, but the character itself doesn't say anything? What do you think of the best example of this is? Thank you for your tireless work. Sincerely, Benjamin.
That is a great question. And this is something that there's a couple of different ways this happens in movies. Sometimes there are characters who, for one reason or another, cannot speak. Mm-hmm. However, there are some characters who are simply there to be more of a presence, and they don't have to, or they can get it all with their presence. Mm-hmm. The example that comes to mind the most for me of this, and I think the best example for me is, and I want to make sure I get the character's name right. So give me here we go. Mm-hmm. Is the character of Joe LaFors, a real historical figure from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Okay.
Speaking of Westerns. But
LaFors, I thought you were going to talk about Mallrats for a second.
Mallrats is inspired by Butch Cassidy.
Yeah, okay.
Butch Cassidy's Sundance Kid, if you've never seen it, it's based off of the true story of two Wild West outlaws played by Paul Newman and Robert Redford. It's considered a classic of the genre, and I think with very, very good cause. And there's an extended sequence where these very plucky, amiable outlaws are being chased across the frontier by a man named LaFors. LaFors is a character we never see or never really get a close look at. We just see him in the distance. I think he has like a white or a yellow hat or something. There we go. He's a white hat.
All right.
That's it. He's just that presence. He's just that figure in the background. It's like It Follows. But like the monster in the background is just the law coming to get you. And this guy just comes to represent all of that. So here are these two characters who are dashing and brave and charismatic and not afraid of anything. And here's this little tiny figure in the distance in a white hat that scares the shit out of them. Mm. That is a character who makes a lot out of nothing. That is a lot out of nothing. It's a great example of this for me.
I'm always fond of characters that we kind of project a lot of emotion onto. Mm-hmm. And don't necessarily display it. I'm reminded of, and this might be a strange example, a 2013 film called Oblivion. It was a Tom Cruise vehicle.
Okay.
Where he's like repairing drones that are sort of scanning the planet for unknown information.
I don't remember which character you're thinking of right
now. Because it's not really a character. He goes a little bit off the grid, and he incurs the ire of drone number 166. Now, the drones themselves are just like these big eggs with like cameras on the front and guns. They're not characters. They're just these floating robot things.
Yeah, but there's one we keep coming back to over and over
again. It crashed and it repaired itself and now it's mad. It doesn't talk. It doesn't have any personality. It doesn't even have a face. But we understand that this thing is now, it's Javert now.
Yeah.
It's like out to get Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
And I like that robot has like all of this personality that we're just sort of projecting onto.
I wonder if that was inspired by, there's this episode of the newer Battlestar Galactica, where the idea of the newer Battlestar Galactica is whenever there are like these like battles in space between like our heroes and their Viper cool space jets or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And then they're facing off against these like more UFO type things. But rather than being piloted by a robot in there, the UFOs are the robots themselves.
Okay.
And because they're robots, when they're exploded, whatever they just were like experienced gets uploaded back into the cloud and they put it into another one.
Okay.
So they're constantly getting smarter. You kill them, they just learn from that mistake. Hmm. And there's, like, one that has been gunned through so many iterations, and it's just, like, the most badass. It's like the Red Baron of Battlestar Galactica.
But it's just really a spaceship.
But it's just the spaceship with, like, a one big eye on it, or whatever like that. It's really cool, actually. Yeah, that's a good example. There's other ways to do this, though, and there's a lot of times there are, like, characters used for comic relief. Harpo the various Marx Brothers movies. He rarely, if ever, speaks. He's just he represents each member of the Marx Brothers represents a different kind of comedy. Harpo represents the more broad physical comedy. Chico represents the more
Fast talker.
He's the fast talker man. Yeah. And then Groucho is more of the like sort of the MC showman vaudeville type. So that's one where just the situation really works for there. You get characters like the unfortunately named Dopey from Snow White. Who a lot of people have a lot of affection for. That's another one where probably not the best representation in a variety of different ways, but,
I just read an article on Dopey.
Wow.
As it turns out, Dopey was inspired by a comedian that the animators saw at, like, the nudie hall down the street when they were done animating.
I did not know that.
Yeah, because they went down to the burlesque hall and they'd see the nude dancers, but there's also comedy and like other entertainment acts in between the nude dancers. And yeah, there was this guy who wore loose clothes and he evidently had a very long tongue.
Yeah.
That was his claim to fame. And they liked the way he moved. They liked his physical comedy. That's Dopey.
Wow.
That's where we got Dopey.
Wow. Another good example of this that people are talking about now, and you know, it's like a lot of the people we're talking about are either comic relief characters or they're badasses. And here's one where a character who technically does speak, but most people couldn't quote their dialogue because they speak so little and what they say is almost nothing. Boba Fett.
There you go.
And the original Star Wars trilogy. There's a
whole series about this guy now.
Yeah, in the original Star Wars trilogy, Boba Fett was a bounty hunter who had, I think he only had like one line, and his line is like, he's good to me, dead.
He's worth nothing to me, dead.
Yeah, he's worth nothing to me, dead. Like, that's basically it. You add your own badassery to Boba Fett because he doesn't actually, like, if you actually look at what Boba Fett does in those movies, leaving out the ancillary universe, leaving out the Star Wars Holiday Special animated segment, and just look at those movies as the canon, which Disney did. What do we know about Boba Fett? Okay, again, only going off of the original trilogy, not going off of the prequels. And even this, that doesn't really affect this. What do we know about Boba Fett from the original trilogy? One, he's a bounty hunter. Fair enough.
He's hired to find...
Han
Solo, right?
Yeah, he's hired to find the Millennium Falcon. And he's hired by Darth Vader. And Darth Vader doesn't only hire Boba Fett. He hires, like, a half dozen bounty hunters because Boba Fett isn't good enough on his own. And when he's talking to all of these bounty hunters and giving them their job assignment, he singles out Boba Fett to say no disintegrations, which is basically him, telling someone off at work. Like, in front of everybody, I'm going to say you do a shitty job of this. I'm tired of you disintegrating everybody when I want them alive. Knock it off, Boba Fett. You suck. And Boba Fett's like, all right. And then Boba Fett figures out that Han Solo's going away with the trash. Fine. And then rather than catch Han Solo and Princess Leia and the droids on his own, he just calls the Empire and has them do it.
He doesn't do anything.
He doesn't do a fucking thing. And then when he takes Han Solo away and just flies away, doesn't really get in the action at all.
No, he takes him
to Jabba's palace, fucks off there for like a year, because a year takes place between those two movies.
That much time?
There's a year between Return of the Jedi. There's a whole thing, oh, we'll find Han Solo. And I'm like, you know he's with Jabba. Jabba's like the king of Tatooine where Luke grew up, so he knows where he is. I don't think it should be that fucking hard, but that's a separate story. And then,
also, isn't there all this subterfuge about like sneaking in?
That plan makes no sense, but that's neither here nor there. My point is this.
I just remember in that movie, it's like we finally have him back and they go up like into orbit to like finally fly away with Han Solo.
Yeah.
And there's this whole fleet of ships waiting for them up there.
Blast them out of the fucking...
Like,
you were just gonna kill Jabba the Hutt anyway.
Take a few weapons down there. It's like, yeah, give us Han Solo or we'll blow up your shit.
Yeah, like, seriously, you were just gonna blow him up. You were gonna kill Jabba the Hutt anyway. What was your plan here? So, like, I get you wanted to ask first, but when that failed, your plan was to kill Jabba the Hutt. So, who gives a shit? Anyway, that's a separate thing. But then, like, so Boba Fett, who has done nothing badass so far, when all the shit starts going down, he starts fighting a little bit, and then he gets bumped into accidentally and falls into the Sarlacc pit. That's it. That's your badass hero. And then in the prequels, yeah, we saw him. He was a little kid. He didn't do a damn thing. Silence was Boba Fett's mask. Because he didn't say anything, he didn't you were allowed to project onto this figure that he was some kind of unstoppable badass because he had a rocket pack. And he actually didn't prove that ever. And one of the things I actually like about the new Boba Fett show is that, yeah, he does some cool stuff every now and then, but he's also kind of a dorkus. And, like, he wants to, like, solve everyone's problems by talking and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I kind of like that. Some people are, like, mad that Boba Fett isn't badass now. And I'm like, good, he never was. It's all from the exterior shit. It's all people projecting out. So that's another example. Anyway, that is it for We've Got Mail. We got to cut it a little short this week. But thank you, everybody, who wrote in. Thank you, everybody, for subscribing to the channel. If you're a Patreon subscriber, especially big thank you for that. We have a lot of exclusive shows on our Patreon, shows about Star Trek, which talked about in this thing. We got shows about every film that's ever been nominated for Best Picture. We got commentary tracks. We've got Batman podcasts. We've got, you can vote for future episodes of our various programs. There's a lot going on over there. If you want to join up, it's patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. If you want to email us here, once again, to contribute to this show and set us ranting and raving as we like to do, our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is the P.O. box? Because I can't remember.
Once again, Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. box 641565. Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah, we're on Twitter at Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
And hey, don't forget, we do have a soap store. Salt Cat Soap is our soap store. We're on social media, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, at Salt Cat Soap. You can find links to the Etsy store there, or you can look at Etsy for Salt Cat Soap, all one word. We make designer soaps. We just released some really cool floral gift sets for Valentine's Day. It's a set of three very colorful soaps, and they all smell like delicious flowers, or I guess aromatic flowers, maybe a bit more accurate. But they smell amazing. Like, our home has smelled, like, amazing since we started making these things. So we hope people enjoy them. We've already sold a few already. There's a few left over, so feel free to fill in those orders. You can get them in time for Valentine's Day. Your loved ones would love you for it. But thank you, everybody, once again, who supported the store and left us reviews. It means the world to us. All right, that's it for We've Got Mail. Thank you, everybody, once again. Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney.